Welcome to Dialogue on Teaching, Wabash Center's podcast series. I am Nancy Lynn Westfield, director of the Wabash Center. Paul Myrie and Paul Utterback are our sound engineers. It is my pleasure to welcome to the conversation Reverend Dr. Isaiah G. Yong. Dr. Yong is Assistant Professor of Spirituality with Claremont School of Theology. Welcome, Dr. Yong, to the conversation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So we are, many of us are, teachers, faculty people who teach religious people. Not only do we teach religion, not only do we teach theology, but we teach people of faith, right? That is a major part of when we teach in seminaries, when we teach in divinity schools. As a person of faith, as a person of active spirituality, right? That's what we want to talk about today. How do you make sense out of learners of faith who are coming to you to study about faith?
Well, in terms of the teaching environment, you know, it's one that I consider to be deeply relational and deeply informed by our own lived experiences, whether they be personal experiences, cultural experiences, familial experiences, as experiences that were passed down to us. And so in that sense, when we talk about studying faith, practicing our faith, or deepening our faith, for me, it's really important that we make room for kind of the fullness of our lives to be brought into that conversation. And for me, the practice and study of spirituality is one such discipline that attempts to do that, attempts to really take seriously our own lived experiences, our lives, what brings meaning to them, the moments that feel joyous and celebratory, and the moments that also feel very difficult and challenging and sometimes unspeakable as well. So it's a kind of whole fullness that the practice and study of spirituality invites to teaching religion and theology and people of faith as well.
When I was in the classroom, one of the challenges was students assuming that whatever their faith expression, their faith relationships, their faith experiences were the, capital T, the ones, and anything beyond those boundaries were not the ones. How do you grapple with inviting students to open, to be more sensitive, to develop sensibilities that move beyond their own experiences?
I really appreciate that question. It's something I think a lot about, especially in our context, which is very diverse at the Claremont School of Theology, with a strong majority of folks, first-generation students, those coming from the global majority, as well as a large population of students who are international students, who are living or practicing their faith, their ministry in very diverse contexts from one another, where it seems very difficult to sometimes find common ground in that. And so, one, the invitation is really to take seriously those contexts and to allow the kind of unique wisdoms that each person and their communities bring into our learning space, which is really important. We definitely want to cultivate that. And then, as you mentioned, to then have another moment where we can not only embrace and kind of cherish our lived experiences, which in our case at Claremont, a lot of these students have never actually been invited to see their own communities and experiences as a legitimate place of authority and a place where they can bring their own wisdom to bear on the larger context. So that's a big task. But then what you mentioned is also really important with that. How do we then get diverse people to talk to one another and take each other's experiences seriously, as well as to really study and listen to experiences that they're learning about or they're reading? And so in that context, we really have a few different ways that we go about it. But one in particular, thankfully supported by the Wabash Center, was a recent grant we were able to pull off, inviting our students to do a kind of localized pilgrimage experience, where we actually invited them to go into somewhere in their community that may not be familiar to them, to actually experience that place in a new way, to listen, to be in connection with, and to give themselves space and permission to really see the diversity of their own context. Now, what that does is that helps them to see that where they're at is full of diverse people and traditions and expressions that are also shaping the way that they show up as leaders or as theologians, as educators. And so in that kind of invitation, we were then able to bring forth those diverse experiences together in the class to reflect on, hey, how was that trip for you? What came up for you? What did you learn about your context? And then what are we learning from each other about the richness that is actually part of this space. And it's pretty a really miraculous conversation. And when you start to get that level of dissonance being spoken out, you begin to have a sense of humility in front of all this, that what we think we know so well and what we're so certain of, what we believe so strongly, and that's great to have convictions and to be rooted in one's own expression, but to also have an encounter where some of those experiences are now brought into a different light through the relationships they developed with each other and their own context is a really powerful experience. So thank you to Wabash for introducing that opportunity for us.
I'm glad Wabash could provide resources for such a great idea, right? Such a great project. It is easier to teach. I'm just speaking from personal experience. It is easier to teach in mono circles and when everybody is as close as possible the same. When you start teaching in diversity, the complications and the complexities can be both mind-boggling and pedagogically impossible, difficult, impossible, right? So we oftentimes, yay, diversity, which, okay, yay, diversity. It's hard to teach in diversity.
Right. Yeah, that's well said. And I would just say amen and say it again, impossible. And that's something that I, in my best aspirations as an educator, want to continue to embrace, that limitation, the finitude of our teaching. I think that's another spiritual disposition that the academy at large may not always cultivate in its own practices and systems of how it produces knowledge. And so, you know, like in our case, right, the ways to approach it could be very overwhelming if you're thinking in abstract, if you're kind of theorizing, you know, and we plan for our classes, but it's a whole nother thing to be responsive to the people who are actually in the class. And it's that kind of dynamic, the adaptability, being led or be guided by, some might say the spirit, some might talk about that a different way, but to be able to relationally be attuned to the people in your class, I think is really important in order to have an embodied experience in that challenge of such diversity. So we don't need to take all the diversity in the world, you know, to bring those to bear in our class, but we do want to bring the diversity of our class to bear with each other. And of course, that's easier said than done, as you've named. And I think it does bring up important conflicts, actually, in terms of not only people's convictions about their spiritual approaches, but also about the ways they feel called to move in the world. And so one of the things that at Claremont we really try to encourage is to embrace the fact that people may have a very different way of going about the same commitment you have, but it might look different. It might even use a different word or a different practice to embody it. And can we hold space relationally for that to actually be true? And so it's not a quite relativism to say anything goes. We're calling to deep discernment, but it's a way of actually making space relationally to recognize that there are different center points at which people connect to their calling, their ministry, their context that are important to become aware of, because we're better together in terms of the unique expressions that we bring. And so that's another part in our class where we want to create spaces where it's almost fully devoted to no content, but just building relationship. And so taking time to actually spend time to get to know each other and hear each other out in terms of who we are, what our interests are, what are our pain points. That is actually is just as much a part of the learning than studying any essential spiritual figure or any kind of assignment or any kind of, you know, output that they're going to have. But it's actually just spending time, you know, getting to really listen and engage one another as people, not just as, you know, people in a class, but as people. And so we want to take that seriously as well.
So I think what you're describing is a learner-centered pedagogy, right? Which is much harder than a content-centered pedagogy. And one of the things, I'm just saying back what you said, one of the things that makes it difficult is the relationality of a learner-centered pedagogy is there's this kind of open-ended. You don't know what's going to happen. So how do you prepare? How have you prepared when you know you are attempting something that you don't know what's about to happen?
That's a great question. And I don't know that you can prepare for what you don't know, but I believe that you can prepare oneself. So one of my spiritual teachers, Raimon Panikkar, often says when he was asked, you know, when you are ready to deliver a homily or a lecture, you know, what kind of preparation do you undergo? And he said, I try not to prepare what I'm going to say because the actual encounter that's going to happen is going to be unique. There's going to be many things going on that I couldn't have predicted. So therefore, to try to impose something specific onto that may actually not be hitting the mark of what was needed. But what he said is the most important thing is to prepare oneself. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, that spiritual posture of being honest with oneself, doing one's own psychological work, sociological work, we could say intersectional work in terms of being in community with diverse people oneself, those kinds of formative relationships and contexts will then prepare a person to be ready in a moment for something that they couldn't have planned. And so a good way story that comes to mind in this is oftentimes when we teach in our spiritual practices course, which I have the real honor of co-teaching with Dr. Johanna Junker, another Wabash, well-known, educator. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we often do, and when we're preparing, we have a sense of what we'd like to cover, but week by week, as different assignments are coming in, as different conversations kind of unfold, we do a check-in moment with each other to say, hey, what did you sense into that moment? And how would we adapt either our assignments or our way to approach the next class to weave into what could have felt like or could have seemed like something we didn't want to happen? Someone was upset about what was said. Someone felt misunderstood by a peer. Someone didn't like how a certain aspect of the class unfolded. And rather than running away from that or discounting that or saying, oh, that's not important, we actually really try to contemplate what actually is going on here and how can we be more attuned to it. Now, we might address it explicitly, but oftentimes it's something implicitly too that we can actually just be conscious of and invite to say, to kind of inform how we show up and as we move through the class. And so in that sense, it's amazing. That's one of the benefits of co-teaching, is that you could actually have, or you'd have dialogue partners on teaching, is that you actually get people to talk with, to discern as something unfolds that you can't have planned or prepared for, or a real life event takes place that's tragic, all kinds of things. If we're going to talk about spirituality, we're going to talk about things that matter in our faith, we can't just act like we're all existing in a cloister. These things affect us. And so how do we change our lesson plan? How do we change our assignment? How do we give people even space with the assignments we assign to actually exercise agency around them, to actually take time for them to say, you know what, this week, I don't know if I can show up fully for that. So we actually even create moments for them to fully participate where they're doing, let's say, 85% of an assignment throughout the semester rather than all 100, because we are planning that there's going to be things we didn't plan for. And so we trust people to take care of themselves and to do what they need to do in that way.
So it sounds so much more complex and so much harder than show up, give a lecture, do Q&A. I'm not even going to say question and answer. I'm going to say Q&A. And that's it, right? So the layer of complexity that's added on to a diverse classroom by co-teaching, it's hard enough to teach it by yourself, let alone then attend to and be present with a co-teacher, all sounds risky to me, right? So it sounds like teaching as risk-taking.
Hmm.
But you don't seem like, it doesn't feel risky to you.
No, I mean, absolutely. It's just the way you're saying it is, it's putting it in a different light. And I feel from the kind of the spirituality side of me is really resonating with that sense, but also the freedom that comes when we choose to accept that life is itself a risk. So we've been so ingrained in a kind of colonial, you know, scientific world where we can determine outcomes, you know, calculate them. We can create algorithms and we can allow for certain processes to unfold exactly how we want them to. And we think we can replicate that universally. And so we've lost this ability to actually be okay with the fact that life is deeply uncertain. Life is deeply a risk. Every time I go out and I take my children to school and we drive just a few miles down, you know, it's a risk. It's a risk. And we might say there's some risks that are a lot greater than others. And I think that's important to also differentiate as we discern how to approach our diverse classes. But what you're saying about being able to lean in to life itself as being one that is not always stable in the ways that we understand it, it's not always predictable, there's actually a maturity in ourselves that we can lean into. And when we have a community that can support it, That's really magical. You know, there's a lot of conversation in different industries outside of theological education that want to bring in spiritual practice to say you can increase your well-being or your resiliency or your productivity by bringing in some meditation, bringing in some different spiritual practices. But it still takes a largely individualized approach to spiritual practices, which misses a lot of the ways in which the community is so important into practicing any practice, to move through stuck places, to move through moments that feel like I'm unsure how to go about this, having community to be in dialogue with, to be supportive, even if it's silent community, like in the cases of monastic communities, but others who are there, who are giving themselves to this kind of risk, this risk-taking process of being alive, having others that honor that, that have reverence towards that experience is something we try to cultivate in the class. We can't demand that, because that has to be come from within each person. But what we can do is invite a kind of orientation to our learning that's less about moving towards a predetermined outcome and module one and module two and module three, and now you got it, to how do we lean into more of the fullness of our lived experience, each other, and how do we develop bonds of connection in this space so that we can be this kind of support for each other in the very uncertain and risky lives that we do live, actually.
And so then classrooms become real spaces, not artificial spaces, for people to actually learn what is relevant and what is needed for themselves and for their community and for one another, right? So I think it's exciting. So Isaiah, you could have picked any vocation that you wanted. Why are you a teacher?
I don't know. I could have picked any vocation. I wanted to play basketball, but I'm 5'7". So... I think that was out of the cards, at least in the U.S. But I am really grateful for the opportunity to be parts of communities that really value a kind of authentic response to our human condition. And education isn't always that, but what I found in theological education is at least is that there are sincere seekers and questioners, doubters, disruptors, who are wanting, in my opinion, to seek out a more authentic way of expressing their own experience and sharing in that with each other. And so that's one of the great honors and joys I have, is learned so much from our students and learned so much from the faculty and all those who support CST and across theological education, is really being able to say, you know what, that's not that, that wasn't my experience when I hear it, but to see someone on that journey of deepening their own sincere expression of that is something that's amazingly rewarding. It brings me life and joy. And I'm really honored, honestly, to be able to share space with people who are on that path.
So I appreciate that. And I think the way you manage your classroom is very different than many colleagues manage their classroom. And the approach that you take to making spirituality a part of your tools, I'm going to use the word tools, as you teach, is fantastic. Right. So my grandmother would say something like, you got to be prayed up before you go into the spaces, the kind of space that you're trying to create. What, do you have personal spiritual practices that you make sure you do out of, because of your pedagogical approach?
Yeah. So there's a few I could think of. One, I was trained in the compassion practice at Claremont School of Theology with Frank Rogers Jr. and Andrew Dreitzer, which is an amazing practice of, you know, turning inward, or as we say, the compassion practice, you know, taking a U-turn. And so the most important moment in terms of, and when applying it to teaching, is instead of just reacting to something, instead of just, you know, doing an immediate knee-jerk kind of thing, you have a moment to actually pay attention to what's coming up inside yourself, to kind of take a pause and to really check in. And I think that approach has been very transformative for me, especially in working with diversity, right? Because what it is, a lot of times with diversity, you're exactly right. We get into this binary, and then a binary that's also a hierarchy of like, not only are they other, but mine's better. And so what the U-turn does is it allows us to say, okay, this is less about whatever's other, whatever's better. That's for another time, but what's actually happening within me. And so it's a much more, like you said, real way to experience the classroom, authentic. It also creates a creative response to be more connected to each other in dialogue, to say, hey, this is perhaps coming up for me as a question of curiosity I have. But I'm also curious like to do more. So just even acknowledging one's own resistance actually gives one space to lean into someone else. Mm-hmm. It can. And so I think the U-turn is a really important practice. I've also been trained as a practitioner within internal family systems. And so that's a really big kind of booming psycho-spiritual approach to therapy now, which really, similarly to the U-turn, really emphasizes checking in with one's parts. That's what we would talk about it in IFS. So we understand that within ourselves, there's a multiplicity of energies, of insights that are always unfolding. And so how do we live have a moment to really check in when we're feeling activated into what our needs are, what our concerns are, and address those so that we're not just doing a kind of savior thing in our teaching or trying to take up too much space, but really in an authentic way, hopefully contributing to the learning of the community. And so those are two really important practices. And then the only last one I want to mention is my co-teacher, colleague, Johanna Junker and I, we recently wrote a chapter for a book coming out on contemplative practices within higher education about the kind of practices we take together into preparing. And so that's a beautiful offering that I believe will come out in the fall, but a lot of it is based on the wisdom of convivencia, Latin American understanding of being in community together, belonging to one another. And so her and I have really developed a beautiful practice, I think, of whether we're teaching, especially in the class we're teaching together, but even as we're teaching in other spaces, a way to be able to have kind of companionship to check in around how different dynamics are unfolding within ourselves, and then also to our goals into, you know, liberatory education, spiritually alive education for others as well. So those are a few that I would definitely lift up.
That's fantastic. So the book is, say the title of the book again, and it's out in the fall, and who's the publisher?
Yeah, Routledge is the publisher. And title is,
he's looking up the title.
The title of the book is Contemplative Practices and Acts of Resistance in Higher Education, Narratives Toward Wholeness by Routledge.
And you and Johanna will come back in the fall when the book is out to talk about the book.
I can't speak for Johanna, but I would love to do that with Johanna if she is so willing to do that with me.
And what project are you working on?
So currently I'm in the midst of writing a manuscript about my own experience living through a near-death accident, motorcycle accident in 2018. Mm-hmm. And not only the trauma that I endured, but also the community that supported me through that and that also transformed through that. So I'm co-writing the book with my father, Amos Young, who's also a theologian and Wabash friend.
Yes, that's right.
We're writing a book about the communal dimensions of trauma and spirituality, and also the ways in which that event invited us to reclaim more of a fullness in our own lived experiences going through that. And so that hopefully will be coming out in 2025. So the tentative title is Spirited Renewal, Contemplations on Trauma and Transformation.
And are you writing in first person? What genre are you writing?
Yeah, it's primarily a first person kind of autoethnography, spiritual autobiography kind of sense. And so, and then I'm inviting my father to also do the same in particular moments where he can kind of reflect on his own experience of living through that as a primary caretaker. And also as someone who, you know, the experience obviously impacted him as a parent, but also, you know, as a theological educator. And his understanding of these processes.
Well, please keep us apprised and aware. Let us know how we can support you and help you and benefit from all that you're teaching, all that you're learning, and all that you are creating, right? Such imagination, such creativity.
Thank you so much, Dr. Westfield. It's been really a pleasure.
To our listeners, the Wabash Center website is the place. Look on our website for details concerning our hybrid workshops, our writing colloquies and roundtables. Our website has information about our educational resources, our blogs, our journal on teaching, as well as our regranting program. A special thanks to podcast producer Rachel Mills, and the music which frames our podcast is the original composition of Paul Myrie. Wabash Center for more than 29 years is exclusively funded by Lilly Endowment Incorporated. And we are out. How was that, Paul?